The First Baptist Church in America was built or was established in Newport, Rhode Island in 1638. And it is not known today as the First Baptist Church of Newport, but it's known as the United Baptist Church, John Clark Memorial. It's got a long name. But this is the interior of it, and this building was built in the mid-1700s. You'll notice that the pews have gates each to them, and there's a place there to put the coals of fire that you had brought in a bucket or the warm brick you had brought along with you to put there in your booth so you could put your feet on it, on them, and keep them warm because it was not centrally heated or anything of that nature. And you'll notice something about the front of this building. That is, it's typically what we call a Protestant setup, in the sense that the Lord's Supper is the most prominent part of it, the table. And on either side, there are lecterns then. And they do this because they focus on the Lord's Supper, and then the other things are more or less secondary. Now, they changed this from the way we have our church, where you've got the pulpit is the main focal point and the most important part of the building and signifies it. And this was done a few years ago because this church is affiliated now with the American Baptist Convention. They have an associate who is a woman. She is an ordained Baptist preacher, quote. And so from being the First Baptist Church in America and being a scriptural church, I believe this church was scriptural when it was organized by Dr. John Clark and others. It has drifted and drifted and drifted until now. It would be like going to a Lutheran church, perhaps, more than a Baptist church. Very high church from the kind of music they have and things of that nature. And it's not very well attended. There was the First Baptist Church, and there was the Second Baptist Church, and the Third Baptist Church, and several other Baptist churches in Newport. But now, the only one that functions is this church, and it's the United, which means that they have all gone together. So if you are in that area, this is a rather small building and not very architecturally overpowering at all. The cemetery where I'm standing with our pastor, Dr. Stone, is where Dr. John Clark is buried. As I said, he was their first pastor. He was the man who helped get them their charter from King Charles II that established them as a colony rather than just being a plantation. It was originally Rhode Island Plantation that Roger Williams had started in this area, this part of what we call Rhode Island now. But he was a great man, a great Baptist. And our people owe him a lot. This is what is written on Dr. Clark's tombstone there in that cemetery that was set aside, just a little plot of ground about as big as the center pews here, maybe a little bigger, for the pastors to be buried. And I think there are about 13 of the pastors buried there. This is an incident that happened with Dr. John Clark and Obadiah Holmes and one other member of their church, who went up just outside of Boston on a Friday night, to see a blind member named William Witter. And while they were up there, they were arrested for not having a license to preach. And so William Witter and others were interrogated, and then Dr. Clark and Obadiah Holmes and another gentleman were brought before the courts and either pay their fines, or one of them was to be whipped, and that was Obadiah Holmes. And he was severely beaten because he said it's not right to have to buy a license to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. And of course, this was in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, which was the Puritan, Anglican, what's now known as congregational group. And he was so severely beaten that he could not lie down for a year. He had to sleep on his hands and knees. He said that as the strokes fell on him, they were like being stroked with roses. The grace of God was so mighty in his life. And before they whipped him, they asked him if there was something he wanted to say. And he said, "My flesh may fail me, and my spirit may fail me, but my God will never fail me." So this is what our forefathers, not in some distant European land, endured. This is what Baptist people endured in America, because Rhode Island was the only colony that had religious liberty of the 13 colonies. There was Pennsylvania for the Quakers, Maryland for the Catholic refugees, the Massachusetts Bay Colony had an Anglican church that was established, not the congregational as we call it now, that was established. Virginia had the Anglican church that was established. You could not preach in Virginia without a license, and they didn't grant license. If you lived there, you had to pay taxes to support the Episcopal priest and to build the Episcopal church building. If you didn't, you were in prison. And this didn't stop until 1775 and 76, just before the Revolutionary War. So really, Baptist people were not free in America to preach the gospel without being fined or in prison until 1792, which is when the 10 amendments to the Constitution were adopted. So from 16 and 8, or whenever you want that 16 and 1 you want to date the beginning of the colonization of America from, till 1792, how many years is that? 150 140, 184 years? Well, that's a long time, you know. 180 years, a long time, isn't it? Baptist people were free only in Rhode Island to preach the gospel without being subject to fines and things. They said, well, people came to America so everybody could be free. No, they came to America so they could be free and persecute everybody else. Now, you say, well, I didn't read that in my history book. I know it. They don't like to put it in the history book. It makes them look bad. But it's the truth. This is where Brother Obadiah Holmes is buried. We had a service there at that particular place. This is Roger Williams, a portrait of him. And he supposedly established the First Baptist Church in America. Although they themselves say that it was organized in 1639, which is a year later than the Baptist Church in Newport, which was established in 1638. But the name of the church at Providence is the First Baptist Church in America, TM, trademark. Okay, just like Coca-Cola's got a trademark, they have their name trademarked, so no one else can ever use it or claim it. Which is a pretty, I don't know, didn't seem like a nice thing to me anyway. And this is a photograph of the First Baptist Church in Providence. You can see how high the steeple is in contrast to the small building. The reason they did this is that in England, no dissenting church could have a steeple. Only the Anglican church or the Catholic churches that had been built early and become Anglican churches, only they could have legally a steeple. So when these Baptists built this church, like most Baptists, kind of got a streak of stubbornness in them, and they just built the biggest steeple they could, I guess, just show people we can if we want to. And that's a little like Baptists sometimes, too. But the inside of it, it's been decorated and redecorated time and time again. This building's built about 1750, so it's quite old. Steeple's been blown over twice by hurricanes that came through there. And there are about 40 or 50 people now that meet there, but it's hardly a church anymore. It, too, is a part of the American Baptist Convention. And it states that they were organized in 1638. They also have ordained women as deacons, ordained preachers and associate pastors, and they have a lot of trouble at Providence. The Rhode Island Baptist College was started, and because of contributions from a family called the Browns who were in this church, it was changed to Brown University, which is the oldest Baptist college in America. Was the old Rhode Island Baptist College, but now it's Brown University, which is a very liberal college now. And I don't suppose that there's a Bible on the place anywhere. This slide here, and I know you can't see it very well, but this is in the Penny Peck Church just outside of Philadelphia. It's in the city limits of Philadelphia now, on Penny Peck Creek. And it was established in 1682, I believe. And on some of these dates, you'll see a variation from a year and a half to 2 years, maybe 3 years. And the reason you see that is because even though they were meeting, they had a minister, they had not built a building. So some people won't date it until they have a building, which shows that they don't understand what a church is, that it's people and not a building. So that's why you'll see these different dates sometimes, that others will date them from the time they started meeting. Others will date them from the time they built their first building. And so that's why you'll see that variation. But this is the pulpit in the Penny Peck Church. And it met there on Penny Peck Creek. There was a flat rock down in the creek where they did their baptizing. And a group of them lived in Philadelphia, and other groups lived in little places 15, 10, 12 miles away. And they would meet in the summer when they could travel and get there by buggy and by walking or horseback. But other times it was very, very difficult, so they'd meet as a group out away from the, quote, mother church. And these became churches. And the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia became a church and separated from it. But here is really where many churches were started, from men who preached here, who went out to do what we call mission work. Brother Joey's talking about going somewhere and other towns and visiting and seeing if there are other Baptists there, trying to see people saved and get a church started. Well, they did this very thing. Their preachers preached all over the area, and churches were started. And five churches in this area organized the first association in America, which is in 1707, called the Philadelphia Baptist Association, and the second was the Warren Association a few years later. So this is very historic here. And the next church, this church you're looking at now where these people are, is the Welsh Tract Church. The Welsh Tract Church, organized by people from Wales who in 1700 were going to come to America. And they were gathered on a pier and waiting to get to board the ship. And they decided, we don't know exactly what's going to happen to us and about a church. So they, 19 of them, organized themselves into a church and called a pastor, so that they sailed as an organized church from Wales to America. And they came to the area around Penny Peck, And they attended church with them for about 2 years, but there was a difference. The church in Wales believed in laying on of hands, and that is when a member joined, instead of shaking hands with them like we do, they laid hands on them. And the Pennypeck church didn't do that, so there was a division over laying on of hands, and this division was never healed, although they agreed that it would not be an impairment to their fellowship. They even agreed that when we meet together, like an association meeting, we won't preach on it. We just won't mention it, because it was not, in their eyes, that important. So the church then bought a tract of land that is in Delaware now, not too far from D.C., and that's why it was called the Welch Tract Church. And this little off-colored brick here in this building is where artillery shell went in it and came out on the other side. See where it's bricked up? And this is the War of 1812. So this building's been there for quite a long time. War of 1812, it was a hospital. In the Civil War, it was a hospital. And they still hold services there today, but it is a hyper-Calvinist church, or what we would call a hard shell church. This is why. You look at the First Baptist Church in Philadelphia, the Pennypeck Church. You look at the First Baptist Church of Providence, First Baptist Church of Newport, and you see that, and the Welsh Tract Church, and you can see there's tremendous difference in these churches. All of them still meeting. One of them is a hyper-Calvinist hard shell. The others are ultra-liberal. Now think with me. As things came along, Sunday school started in the 1800s, okay? And singing with instrumental music or instruments, a lot of things. Women's organizations like auxiliaries, things of this nature. One group of churches adopted everything that came along. The other church wouldn't adopt anything. Some of them moved through this process into total liberalism. The other moved into a state of not doing anything. Now, make up your own mind about what lesson that teaches us. You ought not to swallow every new invention that's offered. If it's not scriptural, don't do it. But if there is something that can be used and it's scriptural, then use it. But you've got to decide that. You can't just be passive and just take everything that comes along. You have to investigate it, make sure it's right according to scriptures, and then do it. You see, churches drift. They don't just suddenly explode into a heretical church. Sometimes take 100-120 years for a church to just gradually shift and drift and become enmeshed in modernism. And that's the best lesson about this thing that we're studying now. This is in Virginia. This building here is built on the site of a jail. And that jail housed Baptist preachers from about 1758, until the Revolutionary War. And this building here was a church. It isn't now, but it was a church building. Because the jail was torn down by the city and offered the vacant lot for sale. And there was a little country church called Mount Pony Baptist Church, 3 or 4 miles out in the country. They came in and bought that vacant lot where the jail had been and built a church on it. I don't know whether they were thinking, you know, now people, that we've got freedom and we can do what we want to, we're going to turn what was worst into what's best. But they did that. As I said, they outgrew it, and this is just another building there. I'm not sure what it's used for now. But James Ireland was imprisoned in the building that was here before this building. James Ireland's a Baptist preacher. When he was in jail here, they intended to kill him. They first put him in jail with a lot of roughnecks and assumed that they would kill him. But the biggest and roughest one there, James Ireland prayed with him and prayed for him and helped him, and he became the defender of James Ireland and wouldn't let other people harm him. I guess that's a good thing to witness and win a man that's big and strong and can defend you, but I'm sure that wasn't what his point was, but that's how it happened. You know, God can use some strange things sometimes, can he not? They burned Indian peppercorns, which put off a terrible acrid smoke, hoping to kill him. And instead of killing him, it just inflamed him with more desire to preach. And so the people would come and put a white cloth on a long cane pole or a long pole and wave it where he could see it. And when he saw that, he would preach to the people, even though they could not see one another. Again, people trying to keep doing God's work in the face of the most difficult circumstances. Then here's another church in Culpeper that was built there. These are just some things I used. We went on to Washington Cathedral, called the National Cathedral, that was built in Washington, D.C. on a hill overlooking D.C. I mean, it's very prominent. And this was built by the Episcopal Church with the idea that it would become the national church. They still had hopes that there would be a church that was recognized by the federal government as the national church or the national religion. And they wanted the president to be sworn in here. Have you noticed lately that there are a lot of functions in the national, senators buried there, a lot of national. Well, this thing is finished now. They just now finished it, and it cost millions and millions of dollars. It's an immense and beautiful thing. But false religion never loses its agenda. If it wasn't for the Constitution, this would have been our state church, probably. Episcopalianism, as we know. But they were persecuting people, and they thought we had come there to admire that place. And I said, no, we're on a church history tour, and we're just showing the people what the persecuting church looked like in Virginia. And made a lady mad who was showing us around. I didn't mean to, except she was so pushy about how wonderful the Episcopalian church was and how wonderful this building was. These are people who are being punished because they violated some of the church rules. Any of you remember what blue laws are? Sunday laws? Well, that's all a part of this here, part of Judaism mixed in with Christianity. And here, of course, is in Concord, where the shot that was heard around the world was fired. And from that, we involved ourselves in a revolution and became a free nation. And then we got together and formed our own government, Philadelphia, and the Liberty Bell there. All these things are tied together. But here in a little park that's been set aside and decorated to an incident that took place here between James Madison and John Leland, okay? Thank you. John Leland and John Madison, and James Madison, rather, believed in the concept of a national constitution or federalism. You may have read in school the Federalist Papers. A lot of controversy. What are we going to become now that we're not tied to England? They're not our government. Should we let every colony just govern itself? Or should there be a federal system? And this was people who in the colonies said, man, we don't want a federal government. All we want is just to be free in our colony to do what we want to do. And others said, look, if that happens, we're going to be like the Balkan countries in Europe. We're going to have separate money for everybody, separate system of commerce for everybody, separate weights, separate measures, and it's just going to be, you have to get passports every time you move from one to another, and our country is just so immense, and we've got such an opportunity. We need a federal government to regulate commerce and to have an army to defend all the colonies, things that we take for granted. Well, this argument ensued until finally, when Madison wanted to be elected to represent Virginia from this area, and John Leland was a Baptist preacher and a very popular Baptist preacher. He was more of an evangelist than he was a pastor. Held a lot of meetings, a lot of people were saved. But here on this site, Madison and Leland got together and decided that it would be better for Leland to run for office, or rather for Madison to run for office and Leland to step aside. And that's why James Madison, who's a person who really pushed the Constitution and promised that he would get something like the Ten Amendments as soon as he could. So here on this spot is where a Baptist preacher stepped aside and let another man and encouraged people to vote for him, is why Madison was elected rather than Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry did not want a national constitution. He just wanted every colony to do whatever it pleased, and therefore they were afraid there wouldn't be anything that would ensure religious liberty. So Patrick Henry had defended Baptists, had been their attorney in many, many lawsuits, but he didn't want a national constitution. The Baptists did, because they wanted a constitution that would guarantee religious liberty in every colony. So that's why they were supporters of Madison, and Leland stepped aside. And that's Brother John Owen, who was on this church history trip with us there. And this is a monument to that occasion. This church building here is a church in Tennessee near Jackson, between Nashville and Memphis, Cotton Grove Baptist Church. And Cotton Grove Baptist Church is the place where a meeting was called by J.R. Graves to decide these issues, these three tenets that I've just mentioned at the beginning of my lecture. And here's what had happened. After the War of 1812, the veterans could take land in the West, which was Arkansas and Tennessee and many other places. They could get a patent on it for having served in the War of 1812. And, of course, we had made the Louisiana Purchase. So now we've got this tremendous place out there that's just unsettled. So people started moving west, and the whole nation began to grow, especially toward the Mississippi River. And as a result of it, there were many small towns that were isolated from most of the other world. But these small towns generally had a Baptist church, Presbyterian church, and a Methodist church. There were really no Pentecostal or charismatic churches at all. They didn't exist in America. They didn't exist anywhere. The Great Revival of 1800, just about what's happening now with regard to the Promise Keepers and the Toronto Blessing churches, all the laughing and the rolling, hence holy rollers, all of the barking and all this happened once before in the Great Revival of 1800. But anyway, you had a Baptist church, Methodist church, Presbyterian church in a town of 800 or 1600 or 3500. And after a period of time, they begin to think, we're having an ordination service. You guys want to come? Baptist preacher and the Methodist preacher, they'd go to the Presbyterian church and help ordain ministers. And then, since Methodists and Presbyterians also immersed, not every time, but if you wanted to be immersed, they'd immerse you. And a Presbyterian wanted to join a Baptist church, he could join on his Presbyterian immersion. Our Methodists could join on. I had a Methodist lady one time, said, Brother Penn, I want to join your First Baptist Church. And I said, well, you know what that means? She said, well, I know you baptized people who have been sprinkled, but I was immersed in a creek right down there, and a lot of your members saw me, so I won't have to be rebaptized, will I? Bad news. Yes, you will. I'm sorry. Can't do that. So when there was meetings in this town, they worked together. And it got to be a very popular thing to do. And J.R. Graves, who came down from Maine, who hadn't been raised a Baptist, but who adopted Baptist principles, came to Nashville first as a school teacher, joined the First Baptist Church at Nashville, and met R.B.C. Howell, who was the pastor there and also editor of the Tennessee Baptist, which was a very popular paper and had a wide circulation. And this was the Southern Baptist Convention now, because it had been organized in 1845. And so now they have in place what we call the Southern Baptist system. Not Southern Baptist churches, but Southern Baptist system, okay, which later became the cooperative program. But the Southern Baptist way of doing mission work, which was through their committee that they had in Nashville, or in, I'm not sure, it was there for a while. But anyway, a lot of stuff, try to keep it short. But Graves started attending First Baptist Church in Nashville, and they had some members that were traveling quite a distance, and so about 14 or 15 asked him to become their pastor, and he did, and the church grew some, and his mother came to live with him. And his mother had been immersed. And so Dr. Graves asked R.B.C. Howell, my mother wants to join this church that I'm pastor of, and you're aware of the members and what we do. And he said, should my mother be immersed again? And R.B.C. Howell said, well, you know, we don't really insist on that anymore. And so J.R. Graves thought about it, talked to his mom, and she was re-immersed. And he began to think, now wait a minute. Is a Methodist church a church, or is it a society? Can we say that the Presbyterian Church, different doctrine, different government, can we say that that is a church, or is it a society? And if we say it's a society, then why do we let them help us ordain our ministers? If it's society, why would we take their baptism? So he began to ask other preachers, what do you think about this? So finally, in 1856, they gathered here at Cotton Grove Church to settle this by conversation and perhaps resolution. So after they met here, because it's halfway between Nashville and Memphis, railroad runs right through it, so they came there, and very convenient, and they decided that a church that does not preach the truth in all things is a society, not a true gospel church. And hence we cannot help them ordain ministers, and we cannot accept their ministers. And so they begin to develop these ideas of ecclesiastical separation. And they begin to talk about, well, what about communion? What about the Lord's Supper? I mean, they've invited us, and when we're there, we take it with them. And when they're at our church and we're having Lord's Supper, they take it with us. But is that right? So they said, no, that's not right either. We shouldn't do that. Well, Graves began to put articles in his paper, Tennessee Baptist, about this. And he went to Bowling Green, Kentucky to conduct a revival meeting, and the pastor was J.M. Pendleton. He talked to Brother Pendleton about this between services, and Brother Pendleton said, I agree with you. And so Dr. Graves asked him to write an article for the paper about what they had discussed and about their beliefs. And J.M. Pendleton wrote an article entitled, An Old Landmark Reset. What was the old landmark that was reset? Ecclesiastical separation, you see. We don't recognize their churches as gospel churches. We don't recognize their envoys or pastors as gospel preachers. And what about the Lord's Supper and baptism, the ordinances? We don't recognize their administration as gospel truth. So that article hit, and churches read it, and it caused a furor, because it began to cause Baptist churches to withdraw and separate again out of this that had been occurring since about 1803 with the purchase of the Louisiana Purchase, and then the northern churches, they were already beginning to grow liberal, and so here we are. So Dr. Graves took that article and some others, put them together in a booklet entitled An Old Landmark Reset, and printed it, and we have reprinted. That's what you see back here. So all the churches that adopted this idea of ecclesiastical churches were called landmark churches. Many Southern Baptists, these were all Southern Baptist churches, really, and they were, quote, landmark Baptists, okay? And after they did that, then they began to see there's some of these things that we really don't like, which sowed the seed for a withdrawing and separation. Now, not every church was a member of the Southern Baptist Convention, quote. Many never joined it, okay? And some of them came out. Dr. Bogard, when he was 20 years old, went to hear J.R. Graves preach. He rode some 20 miles in the buggy and stayed and heard him for a week or two. And in his writings and his biography, Dr. Bogard states, at that time I became a landmark Baptist. And that's what he was. He led in the organization of the American Baptist Association, led in the organization of the old General Association, the old State Association, which was in 1901 a division pulled off because of the way that they were being asked to do mission work. So this wasn't an invention. Landmarkism wasn't invented by J.R. Graves or Ben Bogard or any of these J.N. Hall. They just read their history and said, we need to do it this way. But churches for hundreds of years since early in our history, almost the book of Acts, had been practicing ecclesiastical separation. That is landmarkism, okay? Now, landmarkism is a practice. It's not a name. It's an adjective, okay? But you can use it for a name if you want to. No problem there, because it means we are a church that believe that Jesus started his church, and it's been in existence all through the ages until now. That's number one. The other is we believe that the Lord's Supper is restricted to the church only. We believe in order for baptism to be scriptural, it consists of three things. Not two things, but three things. That is, you got a scriptural candidate, person that's born again and saved. Got scriptural mode, method, immersion. But we believe in something else, scriptural authority. You see, most Baptists believe in the first two. They don't believe in the last one. So these three or four things, they're what make us, quote, Landmark Baptist. Okay? Ecclesiastical separation. I'll be glad to answer any questions you have. I may have to tell you I don't know, but I will do my best. I sure don't have all the answers, but just an overall view of why we're where we're at right now. I hope you've been able to see that. Oh, by the way, that's J.R. Graves there. He's a prolific writer and all. You'll see some of his books. And that's Dr. Bogard, who is really the doctrinal impetus to the American Baptist Association. We've not had a national leader since him. And that's probably good. We don't need one man who's too strong. Did you know that? So we have a lot of brethren who know a lot and lead and help. Sometimes we have a leader who's pretty strong, but not someone just head and shoulders above everyone whose paper and the school he started. Dr. Bogard was really influential in many states, California, Oklahoma. But we thank God for his memory. He wasn't perfect. We don't worship him. But we thank God for who he was and for the stand that he took. God may in the future raise up someone very strong, or he may not. That's in his will and in his providence. Pray for our work. There's always winds blowing to change us into what we don't want to become. Sometimes we're enticed by offers of success if we'll just do this. Never change from truth to error for success. Be faithful.